From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR correspondents around the globe. I'm Douglas Roberts. On the podcast this week, the year in the Middle East and in Iran. Dissidents flee Iran for neighboring Iraq and saving one of the world's rarest animals. President Obama started the year promising a big push to promote Arab-Israeli peace. But his administration ends the year, as one U.S. official recently put it, in a cul-de-sac. The U.S. has been unable to get Israeli-Palestinian talks started again, and many Arab states have been frustrated. NPR's Michelle Kellerman takes a look at the year in Mideast diplomacy.
Israeli Ambassador Michael Oren felt he knew a lot about the U.S.-Israel relationship when he came to the job as a historian who has taught at Yale and Harvard. He spent decades writing about this relationship.
What I had learned as a researcher, as an historian, was actually, in fact, very little, that you learned a lot more about the relationship once you sit behind this desk in the ambassador's office and find out that the U.S.'s relationship is much more multi-layered, deeper, in many ways stronger than anything that I had anticipated.
And that has helped him get through some turbulent times this year. Many Israelis were initially worried about President Obama, particularly his policy on Iran.
The Obama administration came into office with an express policy of outreach, engaging the Iranian regime without preconditions. Our position was, we're afraid.
Now that the U.S. is leaning toward tougher sanctions on Iran, Ambassador Oren sounds more at ease with the Obama administration's approach. The other major source of tension was President Obama's early commitment to the creation of a Palestinian state, an issue he brought up on his first full day in office when he named George Mitchell as a Middle East envoy.
It will be the policy of my administration to actively and aggressively seek a lasting peace between Israel and the Palestinians, as well as Israel and its Arab neighbors.
The president called on Arab states to make positive gestures to Israel, and he called on Israel to stop building Jewish settlements in the occupied West Bank. By May, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton made clear that there should be no exceptions to that, even for what the Israelis call natural growth, adding extra rooms or schools to meet the needs of a growing population.
With respect to settlements, the president was very clear when Prime Minister Netanyahu was here. He wants to see a stop to settlements, not outposts, not natural growth exceptions. We think it is in the best interests of the effort that we are engaged in that settlement expansion cease.
Ambassador Oren said no Israeli government could agree to that. What Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu proposed instead was a 10-month partial freeze of settlement activity, a moratorium that does not include East Jerusalem. Secretary Clinton stopped talking about a full settlement freeze and called the Israeli decision unprecedented. Ambassador Oren says for Israel, this dispute is over.
The settlement issue as a potential source of friction, if not something bigger than friction, in the relationship between the U.S. and Israel, has largely been neutralized by the moratorium.
But the diplomat who represents Palestinians here in Washington, Man Arakat, says he doesn't think the Obama administration is or should be satisfied with the partial settlement freeze.
This partial agreement was a joke to start with. There are already reports in the press that 10,000 settlers will be moving to Israeli settlements in the year 2010. Any moratorium that does not include a total cessation of settlement activities, including in Jerusalem, is not a meaningful moratorium.
The chief of the PLO mission in Washington says he hasn't given up on the Obama administration, though this has been a year of ups and downs.
Our expectations were higher following the landmark speech of President Obama in Cairo in June, and our expectations were higher when the administration took a very tough and firm stand vis-a-vis Israeli settlement activities. But, you know, at the same time, we are not going to completely discard the fact that this administration made it clear that it is in the U.S. national interest to establish a Palestinian state alongside Israel.
Arakat is encouraging the U.S. to come up with, as he put it, the terms of reference for negotiations, to define the end game and lay out a time frame. Only under those circumstances, he said, would the Palestinians be able to return to the negotiating table. U.S. Special Envoy George Mitchell is expected to travel back to the region early next year. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
Unrest continues in Iran. This week's demonstrations were the most violent since those that followed the disputed presidential election last June. At least 9 people were killed. 2009 has seen the greatest challenge in 30 years to the Islamic government of Iran. It has also been one of the most difficult international issues for the Obama administration. NPR's Mike Schuster has more.
It was mayhem yesterday in the center of Tehran. The police used tear gas and truncheons to break up the crowds. Protesters stoned the police, burning police cars and motorcycles. Some police shot into the crowds, leaving a reported 9 people dead in Tehran and in the northwest city of Tabriz. This according to reports on opposition websites. State-controlled television put the death toll at 5. It has been nearly 7 months since the presidential election in June that set off this conflict. It does not look like the challenge to Iran's leadership is going to end. That's making Iran a bigger and bigger problem for the Obama administration. President Obama came into office committed to a policy of engagement with Iran. As the administration slowly set about reviewing its policy, nothing happened until Iran's election. Afterward, it became even more difficult for the administration to establish a workable policy, says Karim Sajjadpour of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
There was perhaps too high of expectations on the United States to unilaterally change the relationship with an engagement approach. I think we're now realizing that we can lead the Iranians to the dance floor, but we can't force them to tango.
Since September, the administration has actively pursued a policy of engagement, even as Iranian police attempted to batter the protesters into submission. Talks with Iran involving the European Union and Russia began in September, focused on Iran's nuclear activities. New revelations about secret facilities raised greater suspicions that Iran is pursuing a covert nuclear weapons capability. Those discussions held out some initial promise, but have stalled. The Obama administration gave Tehran until the end of this year to respond. Now the talk has turned to the possibility of new sanctions. Witness these recent remarks from Secretary of State Hillary Clinton.
We have reached out. We have offered the opportunity to engage in meaningful, serious discussions with our Iranian counterparts. We've been at the table, but I don't think anyone can doubt that our outreach has produced very little in terms of any kind of positive response from the Iranians.
The eruption of protest in Iran took everyone by surprise, including Iran's conservative leadership. Right now, there is no clear agreement among them how to handle the challenge to their regime. And that has complicated the issue for the U.S., says Gary Sick, an Iran expert at Columbia University.
The Obama administration really didn't count on this. The fact that Iran was suddenly going to enter into a period in which the infighting was going to be this intense and where you wondered if anybody was really in control.
As the year progressed, more and more Iran analysts turned critical of the administration's approach. The criticism heard most often, that sticking solely to the nuclear issue with Iran is too narrow an agenda. Mohammed Sahimi, who writes for the website Tehran Bureau, says it's time to put human rights on the agenda with Iran as well.
The United States and Iran should negotiate, but as part of the negotiation, violations of human rights in Iran should be on the table.
Some, especially inside the administration, are skeptical of this approach, but Sahimi says it can work.
There is a perception in the West that the mullahs don't care about the image that they have in the West. But that's actually not true. The mullahs, because they claim they speak for Islam, they actually care about the perception that people have. And that can be taken advantage of.
There's no doubt Iran's government has been severely weakened by the domestic turmoil as well as by revelations about its secret nuclear activities. But in recent weeks, it seems that Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, and those around him have hardened their approach, says Karim Sajjadpour.
And so I think the big challenge the Obama administration faces is how do you reach a modus vivendi with a regime which needs you as an adversary.
Sajjadpour has his own answer. You can't.
As long as Ayatollah Khamenei remains supreme leader and Mahmoud Ahmadinejad remains president, I find it highly unlikely that we're ever going to be able to sign a sheet of paper with this particular Iranian government which allays our suspicions that Iran has abandoned its nuclear weapons ambitions and is now ready to play a more constructive role in the Middle East.
So the year ends for Iran with a likelihood of more conflict, both domestically and with the international community, in the new year. Mike Schuster, NPR News.
The demonstrations in Iran have been centered in big cities, but so far they haven't gained traction in the traditionally rebellious Kurdish province in the northwest of the country. It's very difficult to get verifiable news, but across the border in Iraq, some information is seeping through. While Kurdish Iranians aren't quite ready to join the opposition's green movement, they are helping some dissidents from Tehran escape across the Iraqi border. NPR's Quill Lawrence reports.
When the protests began over the disputed Iranian election in June, Sepedeh Poragai and her husband were already in trouble. As Iranian journalists, they'd both spent time in Iran's infamous Evin prison.
I was in the jail for 110 days, yeah. And my husband was in jail for about six months.
To be released on bail, both Poragai and her husband signed statements that they would no longer be involved in politics. But after last summer's elections, which they believe were stolen, both began writing about the government crackdown. When Poragai got a threatening call directly from a government ministry, she decided her time was up.
I was in danger because I know the truth and it was bad for them.
The two Iranian journalists contacted friends who live in the Kurdish area of Iran, which has a long, porous border with Iraq's autonomous Kurdistan region. Through methods she would not describe in detail, Poragai soon found herself in Iraq, where she gave this interview.
It was the first time that I rode a horse, especially in the mountain. Yeah, it was very hard.
Sitting nearby is the Kurdish man who helped Poragai escape, but he asked not to give his name. He did volunteer that he's helped about 100 Iranians recently, most of them en route to Europe. Poragai is understandably grateful. She says that all of Iran's minorities are part of the Green Movement.
Kurdish, Baluch, and Turkmen, all of them took part in the demonstration.
Her benefactor politely did not contradict her. But one element missing so far from the Green Movement protests has been the organized involvement of ethnic minorities like Kurds, Arabs, Baluchis, and Azeris, who make up nearly half of Iran's population. There are several Iranian Kurdish separatist groups based in the north of Iraq, but so far they're not convinced by the Green Movement. The Iranian Kurdish Democratic Party has kept a base for decades in the northern Iraqi city of Konya. At the moment, they're also hosting a number of exiles from Iran, but these are not members of the Green Movement. They're Iranian Kurds who fled because they say the Iranian government discriminates against them. Salampour is a 33-year-old librarian from the Iranian city of Kermanshah. He fled in June, but not because of strife after the election. He had been working with Kurdish cultural groups, and both he and his wife were fired from their jobs. Next to him, 25-year-old Mohammad Reza Hematgar has a similar complaint. He crossed the mountains the first week of December. We have no freedom in Iran, he says. But Hematgar left mostly because no one would hire him as an architectural engineer. At demonstrations in Tehran, Hematgar heard the Green Movement call for the release of detained protesters. But he says there's been no mention of Kurdish political dissidents who've been arrested or even executed. Another Iranian Kurdish exile agrees. In our hearts, we love anyone who's going to topple the Iranian regime, says a man who calls himself Mohammed. But he adds, we aren't sure that the Green Movement really wants to change Iran so drastically. If it joins its cause with ethnic minorities, says Mohammed, the movement will succeed. But that's something he believes the Green Movement is, so far, afraid to do. Quill Lawrence, NPR News, Baghdad.
Coming up, saving white rhinos.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with super handling all-wheel drive. More information is available at Acura.com.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Douglas Roberts. This month, conservationists in the Czech Republic and Kenya launched an audacious bid to save one of the world's rarest animals, the northern white rhinoceros. Four of the last eight known northern whites in the world were packed into crates and sent from a Czech zoo to Kenya, where scientists hope they will get down to the business of breeding. Nick Wadhams was there when the animals arrived in Nairobi.
It is 3:30 in the morning at Nairobi's main airport when a 747 jet lands with 8 tons of an extremely rare animal, 2 male and 2 female northern white rhinoceros, packed in wooden crates and lying on straw. These rhinos are headed to the Olpejeta Conservancy near Mount Kenya to see if the climate and the terrain will encourage them to get breeding. Hamish Curry directs the Back to Africa program, which helps return zoo animals to the wild. He prowls the tarmac, directing trucks, tractors, and a giant crane as the animals come off the plane.
The trip went very well. They're all relaxed. All, in fact, very settled. But obviously, we want to get them on the road as soon as possible and reduce their stress. So the trucks are waiting now. And we're going to load 2 onto a truck with a crane, fasten them down, and get out of here.
When no one is looking, I climb atop one of the crates and peek in. A dank, musty stink rises from the rhino, which is lying down and asleep. From this angle, it looks like a giant 1-ton slug. It takes 3 hours for a staff of dozens to place the crates on 2 flatbed trucks, and we're off on a 200-mile journey north to the shadows of Mount Kenya. The rhinos were sent to Kenya in a desperate effort to save their subspecies, which was hunted to extinction by poachers in Sudan and the Democratic Republic of Congo. No northern whites have been seen in the wild since 2005. Dana Holikova is the Czech zoo director who pushed for the relocation. Unlike other rhinos, northern whites breed poorly in captivity. That may have to do with the small zoo enclosures where they live, and these animals will be released into a fenced-off 1,000-acre slice of the conservancy.
In captivity, we bred successfully and perfect with 5-generation black rhinos. But of the white rhinos, they are bred only seldom, and nobody knows why. And I'm sure the zoologists will find the key how open this problem. But for the northern white, we have no time. The possibility to start it bred here is more and more better. And that is why this is the last chance for survival. The last chance for the normal breeding, the last chance for the rhino life and the rhino children.
Hours later, it's time at last to release the rhinos into their new pens. Journalists scurry around a crate that dangles and sways from chains held by a rusty crane. Scientists have high hope for this rhino, a 9-year-old female named Fatu, who is in perfect health. When handlers open her crate door, Fatu panics. She wheezes and snorts for her mother, who has already been offloaded. Jan Žarek, Fatu's keeper, who flew in from the Czech Republic, coaxes her out with lullabies and a crust of brown bread. It is panicky, media-saturated scenes like this that some scientists feared. Some rhino conservation groups refused to back the project because of its costs, well into the hundreds of thousands of dollars, and because they thought the trip might kill the animals. All in their pens at last, the rhinos seem calm. That's partly thanks to Barry White, a British rhino handler who helped get the animals used to their crates in the Czech Republic and came along for the journey. She's been dubbed the Rhino Whisperer for her way with the animals.
They do love a lot of fuss and attention and like horses, really, and they really respond to it. So it's been a lot of what we've been doing, really, just making a big fuss of them over the last month. Rhinos respond well to love and being scratched, so the whole sort of aim of the game is to make them as chilled out as possible, so yeah, that's what I've been doing.
Whatever she did, it seems to have worked. After the frenzy is over, a rhino named Sunyi snuffles around his pen, munching hay and checking out the photographers on the other side of a wooden fence. The question now is whether the females of his own species will express the same interest in him. For NPR News, I'm Nick Wadhams at Olpejeta in Kenya.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Douglas Roberts.